Welcome to The Art of the Impossible, a podcast that explores how the design and manufacturing industry can leverage technology, processes, and people to make the impossible possible. I'm Asif Mogul, Director of Market and Industry Development at Autodesk, and each week I'll be joined by industry experts to share the challenges they face and what they're doing to overcome them. From smart products, mass customization, digitization, supply chain, and the convergence of once diverse industries, this podcast is for business leaders who are interested in making things happen. You can subscribe by following us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, welcome to the podcast. So, smart factories. A lot of technological jargon out there. The term smart factory is used in a variety of ways, and it has a multiple set of meanings to different customers. And while the use of the term seems to encompass a multitude of solutions and technologies, it's undeniable that the underpinning principle of those is related to the future of our industry. But honestly, what does smart factory look like in practice? Why should anyone even consider it? And this is what we're going to discuss on today's episode. So to help me navigate this topic is our guest today, Andy Warren, who's the Senior Manager, Engineering Services and Support at Bridgestone Tire. So Andy, warm welcome to the podcast. Great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right, looking forward to the conversation. So let's kind of kick off, Andy. Could you just tell us a little bit about Bridgestone Tires, your role in the company, and the sort of markets that you serve?
Yeah, so Bridgestone Americas is my division of Bridgestone Global. We're the world's largest tire and rubber company, so most of us know us for our tires, our air springs, things like that. And we support everybody globally for tires. So anywhere you go in the world, you can buy a set of Bridgestone tires. In the Americas, the division that I'm in, we support North and South America. My group's a little kind of different because we actually support the parent company out of Japan and Europe as well. So we support globally. And then in my group, we're kind of a support implementation training, kind of a catch-all for all things CAD and engineering support. And we help users. We always like to say we try to make people's lives easier. What can we do to make their lives better through technology?
Fantastic. And so I'm sure many people will be aware of the brand Bridgestone. But in your experience, if you think about the business, how has it changed? How has the business changed in the last 5 years? And what do you think were the catalyst for the kind of like changes you've seen happening in the industry all around you?
Yeah. So, you know, Bridgestone, we're an old company. You know, we've been around over 100 years. So we're not, you know, a startup. We're not a new organization. And it's interesting. I've been here about 12 years now, and coming in, not knowing a whole lot about Bridgestone, there's a lot of automation. There's a lot of robotics. There's a lot of advanced technology. And then there's also, you know, some legacy technology, legacy facilities. And in Americas, we can make tires, you know, cheaper than you can make them in China because of our automation and our efficiencies that we gain here. And so as we go through time, as I've been here, really seeing them adopt digital and smart factory in the last several years, definitely since COVID hit, and we've seen that as a huge catalyst to drive that technology portion of it. And it just accelerated. You know, every day there's something new where we're trying to use technology to solve a problem that in the past may have thrown people at, but now we're trying to use the technology to solve some issues.
But you mentioned COVID in terms of when you think about the impact of COVID on Bridgestone, were there any particular kind of like problems or issues that it highlighted that you thought, okay, I think this is something we need to look at?
Yeah. So, you know, starting out the gate, you know, first, no travel, you know, everything was grounded. Everybody couldn't go anywhere. So how do we get people there? How do we do, you know, design reviews remotely? How do we virtually walk through a plant? How do we get that data to an engineer that may be based at corporate or based in Europe for a vendor or something like that? How do we do factory acceptance tests? You know, so that was the obvious one. The other thing is that a lot of people are experiencing, you have a lot of retirement. We have a lot of older generation. When I started at Bridgestone, it was not unusual to have people here 40, 50, 60 years in the company. As you get this turnover, now you have to train all of these new people. Well, travel is restricted. You can't get to them to train them. How do you do that? How do you get the technology to help carry that tribal knowledge from one generation to the next? And so that kind of highlighted a couple different issues with that is how do we do more with less? Not because we want to spend less money or anything like that, but because we can't hire people. There's not enough people out there to hire. We're like everybody else. So we're always trying to attract talent and get new people. But how do we get those new people up to speed? How do we get them as efficient as possible in the shortest time possible? And so, you know, the easy way to do that, of course, is technology.
Okay. So really doing more with less when you don't really have a huge amount of other options. I suppose that, if I hear you correctly, that's the sort of like the problem that something like COVID surfaced within the organization. And what was the impact of, I mean, was there an impact of trying to solve those problems in a non-digital way? Are there any kind of examples you could share of you know, the challenge of, or the impact of trying to solve those types of problems in traditional ways?
At Bridgestone, we cover a lot of different, I support a lot of different areas. So everything from your building, you know, BIM information modeling, into mechanical design, electrical design. We have an XR innovation group. We do laser scanning. We do a lot of things under my team. You know, I think the easiest one to point out is the building stuff. You think about BIM information modeling, that technology's been out for a long time. You know, people have been talking about it and implementing it for years, but large companies are slow to adopt that and don't really understand it. And so, you know, in the past, they would just put more engineers on it when they didn't have the information, or they would, you know, they would have a bunch of engineers poring over PDFs or paper drawings trying to figure out how to do something. And you know, we've converted them over to, you know, a 3D world where we're looking at things in three dimensions because we're trying to prevent issues. We're trying to stop it before it becomes a problem. And if we can model it in 3D, you know, then that becomes a way to save that. Whereas before, you know, we had engineers, teams and teams of engineers trying to calculate something or figure out why something won't work or won't fit, you know, or even worst case, you get out there to the building and it's not right. And now all of a sudden you have to go back and do a change order, or you have to cut something, you have to make something new. So you're delaying your startup time. You're putting more load on the engineers, putting change orders into the system and doing things the kind of the old fashioned way. Or another good manual way is we have a lot of older machinery that we continuously upgrade. I was just in Costa Rica a couple of weeks ago, and we have a calendar there from 1949, but it's fully automated. We took the old frame and we added on intelligence to it. In the past, they would go out there with tape measures and we'd have people measuring this stuff to figure out, you know, where do I put the encoder? Where do I put the new electronic controls and things like that? Now we go out there, we scan it, we create a 3D model. We know where it will fit, but also how do you get the rollout? Because, hey, they still got to work on this thing every couple of years and take it apart. So you don't want to put something in the way. So we actually can put in that extra intelligence past just the design or, you know, the modification, but into, you know, kind of that next level of future-proofing it, so to speak.
You guys, I mean, when I met you before at a conference, you were talking about Bridgestone's implementation of Smart Factory. I'd love to understand why you felt that was the place for you to start, or the next step in your journey. That's sort of part one of the question. Part two of the question would also be, but what is your definition of Smart Factory? So, well, maybe we could start in that order. What is your definition of Smart Factory? And then why did you choose that as a thing to be the next step in your digital transformation?
So to me, you know, the term Smart Factory or digital twin, things like that are loaded questions. Because if you ask me, you get one answer. If you ask, you know, my vice president, you get another answer. If you ask my CEO, you get another answer. And that we're all looking at it from different lenses. And I think for me, I have a portion of Smart Factory. We actually call it digital foundation, because we didn't want to be confused with digital twin, because in our opinion, their definition of digital twin wasn't right. You know, when my management's thinking about digital twin, they're thinking about scheduling and production and how do they get more production out through, you know, something that may be based on a spreadsheet. Where when I'm thinking of digital twin, I'm thinking physical objects. So we called it digital foundation because that's a portion that goes into that digital twin. The other side of it is you know, digital twin is all about data. You know, getting data from one process to the other. So you're not throwing away data at every step and regaining it. You know, the McClaney curve, there's the sawtooth model. There's a bunch of different models out there for BIM and 3D design where people have talked about this for years. And it's still a very real problem because companies tend to be siloed. You have different departments that are responsible for different things, big companies, big silos, and it's hard to get that in there. So digital twin or smart factory to me is all about the data, getting data to travel from one process to there, sharing data. You know, that's really what makes a smart factory, is being able to use the data from one process to the next, to the next, to the next, so that as you're working on things, you're not losing data. You're not recreating it at every step. You don't have two different sets of a single source of truth, so to speak. You have one single source of truth that everything's based on.
You said that you call your portion of that digital foundation. So could you expand on the definition of digital foundation in the context of your business? What does that mean to you?
So to us, our digital foundation is capturing the digital data of an asset, either before it's built or after an existing piece of equipment's out there. You know, I need to go out there and get a scan, and we 3D model, reverse engineer it so we can either add to it, modify it, recreate it, build another one. Same with buildings, equipment, parts, pieces. So we do a lot of scanning. I have area scanners, we have arm scanners, CMM measurement devices, hand scanners. You know, we have a plethora of measurement devices that where we're capturing that data. So you're capturing data, you're also getting digital design data. And then that's what everything's based on, because even a schedule theoretically can go back to a digital twin. If I need to know how many seconds it takes a tire to travel down a conveyor, it matters how long that conveyor is. If you ask a scheduling guy, they say they don't care how long the conveyor is. They just, you know, it's just a number on their spreadsheet. But in reality, the length of that conveyor affects how long it takes to get down there. So that is an input to them, is what is the length of that conveyor, so they know travel. What is, you know, is there something physically in the way that the AGV can't go in between two machines? It has to go down to the end of the aisle and come back. You know, that's a time number that affects the speed of that AGV, that affects throughput, that affects scheduling and everything else. So everything really does go back to that basic digital information on a physical asset. And you know, Wikipedia says that, you know, a digital twin is a digital representation of a physical object or process. But I think even a process is based on that physical object. I always tell my people the only reason we do drawings is for communication. Doesn't matter if it's a 2D drawing, a 3D drawing, a 4D drawing, whatever it is, you're doing that to communicate with somebody. You don't create a drawing just for the sake of creating a drawing. You're doing it so you can talk to somebody, either a pipe fitter that needs to run pipes, or a scheduler that needs to schedule something, a maintenance guy that needs to repair something. You're creating this communication device that says, this is where this part should go. This is where this bearing should go. 3D makes it easier to describe it versus 2D. You know, and then you add in 4D where you show the machine moving, it makes it even easier to describe. But you're really just communicating to another person what that machine should be doing to produce your product or to do whatever process you need done. You're figuring out a way to communicate with other people. So to me, that's that digital foundation, is creating that asset or whatever it is to be able to communicate better with somebody about what you're doing.
I really like the way you described that, Andy. And as you were talking, I guess the way I'm interpreting it is that it's almost like you're building a set of intelligent building blocks that get fed into this ultimate vision of whatever your smart factory or digital twin is. And I suppose that totally makes sense, because if you have unintelligent pieces of information going into the smart factory, then it actually doesn't become very smart. You know, I get the sense of these are intelligent building blocks based on the physical assets that go into the factory. Would you say that? Have I understood that correctly?
Exactly. So, you know, we do a lot of that where we're building Revit families, factory design assets, things like that, where we're trying to build that asset that when you make a change, you know, us CAD guys, I come from the CAD world. I've been doing this for a long, long time. You know, you start out on the board and you go to CAD because you don't have to draw it twice. You can modify it. Then you go to, you know, either AutoCAD Electrical or Inventor or something like that, where you start getting parametrics and you can change things. My electrical people love it whenever they have to renumber wire numbers. If you got a 300-page drawing set and thousands of wire numbers, the AutoCAD Electrical tool that says renumber is worth every dime they have to pay to do that, because they can renumber 3,000 wires in a click. You know, getting that data that's smart, intelligent, and moves with the design intent as things change, yeah, that is an intelligent idea. Is how do we get that data that's not static? You know, it's a live data board of data, so to speak. As the model changes, we can change and see it go through the different processes. What if we do this? What if we do that? You can see what happens to it.
Fantastic. So I guess of all the things that you could have decided to focus on as, you know, the next stage in Bridgestone's digital journey, what made you land on the digital foundation? Why was that the thing you thought, okay, this is what we should really look at first before we do anything else?
So I think it started years ago when I first started at Bridgestone. I came in, I thought I was going to be out of work in like 6 months because I was going to deploy Vault and 3D design, and it'll take me like 6 months to roll it out, and then I'm going to be looking for another job because it's going to be so easy. And then I realized that the technology isn't the problem. It's changed leadership and getting people to change. And so we added bits and pieces over the years. I didn't come in and create a department that had all of these different kind of tentacles going out in these other areas. I came in to help solve a problem for a friend, and then it grew and grew and grew, and the problem got bigger and bigger and bigger. That's really kind of where it came from is we had all of these kind of different solutions. And I said, wait a minute, this is all really basically the same thing. We're doing scanning, we're doing BIM, we're doing, you know, FEA analysis, we're doing some CFD work. We want to get all of that into a bill of materials into the vault. And then we want to do a 3D design review and a virtual reality headset. All of that is using that same data. And we need that data to go from process to process to process and be the same and be updated at the same time. And trying to explain that to management as we go. And one day my boss and I were just showing, what are we talking about here? All these different things we're working on. What are we talking about? And we said, you know what? Really, we're talking about the same thing. All of these different things are there's a digital thread carrying the data between it. And it's all based on, you know, this data of the machine or the part or whatever it may be. And I said, it's really more of a digital foundation because we were using the term digital twin. A lot of people love to use that term, but our management was using digital twin for something else. And we said, you know what? We don't want to confuse them. We don't want them to misunderstand, think that we're talking about scheduling a warehouse. We're in the CAD department. Why does the CAD department care anything about the warehouse scheduling? No, our digital twin is something totally different. We're not talking about scheduling. We're talking about the bits, pieces, and parts. And so he said, what can we call it? And so we came up with the digital foundation as it ties to the digital twin. They understand it a little bit easier, and it explains a little bit that this is what the digital twin's built on, and it helps build that digital thread or that smart factory journey is based on that kind of that geometry inside of CAD.
So it sounds like you kind of almost stepped back from the problem. You walked into the organization, you observed a lot of things that were happening, and I guess you could describe them as silos of digital technology being used in kind of maybe very disparate ways. And if I understand what you're saying is you kind of almost took a step back from that and just kind of asked yourself maybe a slightly bigger question. What are we doing here? What are we trying to achieve? And from that, through conversations with some of your colleagues, you kind of built this definition of foundation. I think you clarified what digital twin meant or doesn't mean for you. And from that, it sounds like you almost built the first step towards your ultimate digital twin strategy. So almost like stepping back and really observing what was going on.
Exactly. As we trying to figure out how you explain that to other people, how, you know, the management knew that we were really part of, you know, the digital journey, but they didn't understand how to vocalize that. So we were figuring out how do we vocalize that? How do we explain how we fit into that? Not because we wanted to fit into anything. It's more of just big companies. You're always, how do you fit in? How do you get to the corporate goals? How do you align to our global overall corporate mission and statement and values? And so that's when we kind of came up with that and said, yeah, this could be a solution to solve that explanation problem.
You made it make sense to the business as opposed to here's a bit of technology we should play with that you kind of like, actually, here's something that could actually contribute to the corporate goals. It just happens to be technology. So how on earth did you start rolling this out? This is the question a lot of people, you know, love to understand is, just like you said, my perception is I'm going to come into the organization, implement a piece of technology. I'll be out of here in 6 months and I'll be on to my next job. And the reality is it sometimes takes longer. I guess the secret sauce that a lot of our listeners are into is like, how did you go about rolling this out? Because it doesn't sound like an easy change to manage in the business. So where did you start?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, how do you eat the elephant? One bite at a time. You know, we were brought in, I was brought in for some issues, and it really started out kind of around licensing and things like that and figuring out how do we get standardized and that. And I said, hey, if we standardize on this and we move to this and we standardize on Vault and we use data management as our standardization to start with. And then we started adding in 3D scanning and said, okay, how do we get to there? And some of that 3D scanning, we started out outsourcing. You know, I would outsource that to somebody else and we paid, you know, some quite a bit of money for that. And then we said, okay, now what can we do to reduce our cost? Oh, if we bring this inside, we buy our own scanner, we could save quite a bit of money here. So then we bought over the years, now we're up to 3 scanners, area scanners. We have an arm scanner, we have a tracker, we have a hand scanner. And it just slowly has organically grown as we've gone. We found the low-hanging fruit. We found the pain points. My boss likes to say, we found the people that wants to play the game. If you want to win the game, you got to find people that want to play the game. And so we found people that wanted to work with us and be successful. And those are the people that we worked with first. You know, you never win by coming in and forcing people to do it your way, so to speak. You gotta win them over. Sometimes it's frustrating. Sometimes that's hard because it is a change leadership exercise, so to speak. And trying to figure that out was not easy. But we looked for where are the things that we can win at. Data management was a problem. Okay, we can win those people over. Then some smaller projects for us that we were able to show value on 3D modeling, FEA, CFD. You know, there's a lot of times where we got called out in the middle of the night for this emergency project and we were able to come in and kind of save the day. And we built up our reputation. And from there, we were able to deploy new things. Hey, boss, there's this new thing out now that we can do. We think we can do this and save even more money on this project and able to show from our past, you know, kind of performance that we can do this with this newer, whatever it may be. And they've always trusted us to do that. The other side of it is we did have to show value in that. So sometimes we were making up ROI, and I don't say making up like faking it, but we were having to come up with new KPIs to measure what we were saving. We didn't do 3D scanning before. So how do you say 3D scanning saves us money? Oh, well, in the past, we would pay somebody to go measure this. Okay, how much would that cost? And we'd figure that out. Then we said, okay, now if we were to use 3D scanning, but we outsourced it, what are we going to pay to outsource scanning? Oh, this is about 10 cents a square foot, 15 cents a square foot, somewhere in the neighborhood of that for an average. So we show, hey, we scanned this many million square feet and we saved this much money on it. From there, we go out and you know, we show savings on downtime. We get changes. We reduce change orders. So you can look at the last project and say, hey, we had these change orders where we had these misses on a design. We were able to catch these misses this time. Usually not everybody believes you. Well, we would have caught that in a 2D design review. I'm the best 2D design reviewer there is, you know. So we try to be very conservative with it. To be honest with you, all of our savings numbers were super conservative, partly because we don't want to be wrong, but also partly so people will believe us. Sometimes we have numbers where we're like, hey, we could have saved, you know, these zillions of dollars, so to speak, and people don't believe you if it's too big of a number. There's no way we'd say that, you know, or there's no way we would have spent that or whatever it may be. So we show our math a lot of times in our ROI and say, this is how we got to this savings number, and this is what it could have saved. And then we give specific examples of before and after. You know, I think I shared the conference you were at, you heard me speak it. Before Vault, we had a time where a plant manager had 12 hours of downtime, 30 minutes to fix the machine, and the 12 hours of downtime was finding a drawing in the old paper system. He went several months later, we'd been on him about using the Vault and looking for it there. He calls his wife, says, I'm not going to come home for dinner tonight because I'm going to be all night working on this machine. Finds it in the Vault in 5 minutes, gets the machine fixed in 45, and is home in time to make dinner. And that's the kind of things that showing that those wins and those successes is how we kind of got started early on.
I remember that example you gave, and it was pretty impactful. So as the world is today, what results are you seeing as Bridgestone overall, thanks to the kind of digital foundation? Are there kind of like some now widely accepted results or successes that the company's enjoying as a result of your investments?
You know, now whenever we start a new project, every project we go out and scan, 3D design, BIM is required on all of our expansion projects. we require 3D models from our vendors now, just slowly winning people over. We're seeing that more and more, the savings. We still see the ones where the people are like, oh, we don't need a 3D model for that. This is just a simple change out. And they go and they change it. Come to find out the machine was 4 inches wider in the new version than it was the old version. Okay, no big deal, but the catwalk won't attach. Oh, and you have to have the catwalk to thread the machine. So therefore, you can't run the machine until you redesign the catwalk and re-engineer it and re-bolt it on. So 3 days later, so, you know, they lost 3 days of production on that machine, which is a very known number. That's a huge number. We said, hey, what are you going to do next time? Next time, we're going to do it in 3D. We learned our lesson, you know. And we're seeing more and more of those times where they're coming to us and saying, okay, let's do it the right way. Let's not do it the wrong way. And we find things and we share it. And we say, hey, look at this, what we found. Hey, this motor is only a foot from the wall. Well, when I talk about a motor, it's a 3,000 horsepower electric motor. So it's a pretty good sized piece of equipment. It's less than a foot from the wall. They got to get in there and work on it. I mean, if anybody's ever worked on a car and you've had to try to get your hand in there to change a spark plug or something, you know how hard that is. Imagine a motor that's, you know, a meter and a half in diameter. You know, it's a huge piece of equipment. Trying to work on that in a tight space is not easy. We can find that in 3D. We can show it to them and save them that heartache down the road. That may be 5-7 years down the road before they see that savings.
So it sounds like it's having, you know, definite positive impacts for the business. What about the relationship it's having with your customers? Has that relationship with your customers changed in any way? And how would you describe that change?
Well, kind of depends on who you count as a customer. So for us, our customer are the plants and the manufacturing facilities. We consider that to be our customer. If you're talking about the end customer that's buying tires, it's a little bit different story. You know, we are the largest, but we also try to provide the most value for our customers. So anytime we can reduce manufacturing cost, we can reduce downtime, we can reduce maintenance cost, you know, that helps our customer by keeping our product costs low. We also have a huge push that we call E8. It's basically how our company makes an impact on society. So you have environmental, you have ecology, you have economy. So it's a value for our customer. It's a value for our shareholders. It's a value for society in general. And so anytime we can do things that reduce the amount of energy, that reduces the carbon footprint, then we're helping our customer and society as a whole. And Bridgestone has a huge push on that. And they are a firm believer in doing what's right for society, not just what's right for, you know, the boardroom, so to speak.
Wow, that sounds like one hell of an impact as well. So I suppose the next thing that people always are interested in is on your journey, were there any kind of really major roadblocks that you experienced as you rolled out this kind of concept of the digital foundation? And if there were, and that you could share them, what was your strategy for overcoming those roadblocks?
Well, I mean, we only have an hour, so I can't go through, you know.
Okay, is that bad? Is it?
You know, really and truly, I think the biggest thing has always been change leadership, getting people to change how they do things. This is the way we've always done it. You know, how many times do you hear that? Those are always the hard roadblocks. The technology, that part is easy. That part is simple to get things going and working correctly. It's the changing of people's minds, hearts, and getting them to believe in doing something different. You go to somebody and you say, check out this new technology that can save so much money on this project. And they look at it and they're like, I was at a conference and I heard somebody talk about the difference between fans and supporters. And they said, fans go to the high school football game every Friday night and support the team and cheer it on. Supporters drive the bus with all the equipment to the away matches. So you go talk to somebody and you say, hey, this is this cool new technology. We save so much money on your project. And they're like, oh, that is awesome. I definitely think that that's going to save the company lots of money. Oh, can we use it on your project? Oh, no. I'm 6 days into a 5-year project that, you know, I can't go back now. I'd lose all 6 days that I've been working on this already. What do you mean? You're only 6 days into a 5-year project. You know, and winning those people over has really been the hard part to get people to understand and getting, you know, we're converting that data, we're transferring that data, getting people to believe in the data and understand that it's really, and it's actual and it's trustworthy and things like that. It has been a roadblock as well as getting them to understand that we're not trying to replace people's jobs. We're not trying to do away with people. We're trying to make people's lives easier. And that's always a battle that I have. You know, I had that battle today. You know, I have that battle every day I come to work. is getting people to understand that I'm trying to make their lives easier, not harder. Sometimes it's harder up front because we are changing how they do things. But in the end, it's going to be much, much better. You're going to get a much better result in the long run. So getting people to believe in that and winning their hearts and minds has really been the biggest challenge of all.
I'm kind of, what's your secret in terms of how you do win their hearts and minds? Is it sort of like the softly, softly, gently approach with little bits of data and kind of a lot of small, safe steps? Or is it more of a, let's sit down and really thrash this out?
So we have a bunch of different processes. Bridgestone, we do the DISC assessment. I don't know if you ever heard about that. It's four color feedback, and it's like, what personality, what color are you? So you kind of have to have different approaches for different people. Some people learn through data. Some people are emotional. Some people like to talk it out. Some people just like the facts, you know, and how you handle that is different per person. Some people, you know, you have a carrot and a stick. Others, we call it boiling the frog. You know, you start turning the heat up so they don't ever know it before it's too late. They're already there and they don't realize it. It just varies from person to person. We have to kind of tailor it. You know, obviously we're going for leaders and we're going for people that are, you know, we need to support it. For the most part, management, when you say it's going to save us money, they don't care after that. You know, they're on board to save money and to save resources and make things easier. It's the people in the trenches you have to win over. And like I said, some people you show them data and you explain to them how it's good for them. Other people, you know, they need the stories. They need the examples. Yet others, you know, we have to get management to force them to let us do maybe a small part of the project so they can start to trust us and understand where that's coming from. And, you know, we try to win them over with honey and get them to really understand and not force them to do things. Because my experience is if you ever force anybody, it never ends well. I have teenagers at home. That doesn't work well with them either, you know, unfortunately, sometimes. But we want to win them over and we want to show them that we're here to help them and see them successful.
I think I say this on almost every episode, but it really does come down to the people. People could be the reason why a transformation is hugely successful if you approach it correctly. And people can often be the reason why a transformation isn't successful. It seems to have less to do with the technology and more to do with the people and the culture of the organization. I love the fact that you're kind of describing really just know your people and kind of almost know how to engage with them and what motivates them and just adapt your approach to sort of convincing them in that respect. So
I always tell my people to go for the things that nobody else wants to do. If you do the job that everybody hates and nobody wants to do and nobody likes, and we can figure out how to automate that first, that's a huge win for them because they hate doing whatever that is. So if you can do something that's a pain for somebody and they just really don't want to do it, sometimes we do it for them. You know, we'll do all the design work for you and then give it to you. So you don't have to worry about whether it's 2D or 3D. You know, so there's always that figuring out, like you said, how do you win those people over? But, you know, doing as much as we can for them and to, like I said, anything you can do that nobody wants to do and you can automate that, that's a win right there.
It's almost like you treat your people as customers in their own right, from the way I'm saying it. I mean, it's kind of like the way you're describing it is almost the way you would just deal with a customer, whether it's, you know, an internal customer or an external. But you're treating your team as customers as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I explain to people that are familiar with Autodesk and Autodesk sales channel and things like that, we're a lot like an Autodesk reseller inside of Bridgestone. Because we're providing technical support, we're providing training, we're providing implementation, consulting services. We're actually doing some 3D design work. We're doing scanning. We're doing all these different things for our customers that are the plants and the engineers and the plants and corporate engineering. So we're here to help them be successful. The difference is we don't have quotas. We don't have, you know, some of the sales headache that those in the true sales channels do. But we're really here to help our customer, and we consider them our customer when we're talking about the plants and engineering, because that's what makes us successful. Is when they're successful, we're successful.
Fantastic. So we're going to sort of coming to the sort of the last chunk of the podcast where I'd ask you sort of a couple of questions. One is, if you jump back in time to the starting point of like rolling out the digital foundation, so if you had to do it again, would there be anything, Andy, that you would do differently this time, and why would you do that differently?
Looking back, hindsight's 2020. There's a thousand things I would have done differently. Some things we were told there's no way you can do that, so we had to do it the hard way. I go back to even licensing. Early on, we had distributed license servers at every facility. So I had like 47 license servers I had to maintain. And then we eventually combined that to one license server. And now everything's in the cloud with named user. You know, going back, if I just had one license server, it would have worked fine, you know, but to keep people happy, we had to do it the hard way. Same with the centralized vault. To be honest with you, we probably had to do that because of our bandwidth at the time. We now have more bandwidth and we can have a centralized vault versus having a distributed vault architecture. So that's made a lot easier. Some of our XR stuff where we're doing design reviews and training, in the beginning, we were doing things, you know, as small as we could because we're trying to have as little impact to the negative to somebody if something, you know, didn't go wrong. But at the same time, you end up with scope creep. You know, that's always consultants' worst nightmares. You start on a project and 2 years later, it's never taken off because they keep scope creeping you, you know, things like that. So I think earlier on, I would have set up better rules of engagement. You know, like you get a scope of work from a vendor, and sometimes that's good because you say, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And this is what we're going to do for this thing. Anything past that becomes phase two, or we improve it the next generation or whatever it may be. And making sure we're very, very clear with the customers, this is what we're going to give you for what we're doing this time. And so making sure that they understand that. So I think going back in time would have put much more detail into some of that kind of stuff where we spec'd out, this is what we're going to give you. This is what we're expecting. Past this point becomes phase two. This is our drop dead date. You know, it's the line in the sand for development and we're going to go live with it. And then next one's going to be phase two versus waiting and waiting and waiting and keep kicking that can down the road. So there's several different iterations of that all over my group where, okay, looking back, I would have just done it this way. Sometimes you can't though. Sometimes you're not allowed to, or there's something preventing it.
Okay. That's a great bit of insight. So last couple of questions then, Andy. Let's say you bumped into somebody at a conference who might be in a similar kind of like role or position as yourself in maybe a different industry. And they say, oh man, I think I'm looking to get into the world of smart factory. What advice would you give them in terms of where they should start?
You really can start anywhere. Smart factory, you know, when you really break it down to its bits and pieces, you know, we're doing a lot of it already. We've been doing it for years, 3D design, BIM scanning, things like that. It's really figuring out where is your pain point in your company? Where can you save the most money for the least impact? You know, there was a guy, actually, I think he used to work for Autodesk, Brent Michon, and he always said, you think big, start small, and scale fast. So think about it big picture-wise, how you're going to handle it if it goes company-wide in 10 years, but also find a small win that you can do, start it, but then make sure that as you do it, it's scalable. It's not a one and done. It's a phase one, phase two, phase three kind of thing. And so I always use his advice to this day. It's been 10 years since Brent told me that. Think big, start small, scale fast, and that wins every time.
Great advice. Thank you, Andy. So then the final question we have for you is there a book or a podcast or something you're reading that you're drawing inspiration from that you would recommend someone else looks at?
Yeah. So I mentioned the DISC assessment, four color feedback. There's a bunch of different personality tests out there and how people communicate. Anything like that where you can learn how to be a better communicator, because this is change leadership. You're trying to communicate with others. I've taken a couple classes on that. I make all of my people that work for me go through the DISC classes and read about how to communicate with others based on what color they are. And I actually have one coming up here in September where I'm going to be taking it's kind of the next level of that to know how to communicate with others better. But knowing your audience, how to communicate with the different people in different ways. And I'm sorry, I actually had the name of that book in my mind and I didn't write it down on a piece of paper to share with you guys, but it's DISC assessment or personality test. There's a bunch of them out there. It doesn't really matter which one. They all kind of do the same thing. But it's really just understanding who you're talking to and how to communicate with them, whether it be your direct employee, your boss, your customer, your leadership, whoever it is, everybody communicates in a different way. And you have to understand how you're communicating with them to ensure you're getting the communication the best possible way.
That's great advice, Andy. So now what I've got to try and do is I'm going to try and summarize everything I think I've learned from our conversation today. I'm going to ask you to give me feedback to see if I've captured it correctly. So kind of here goes. The theme of the podcast was really on Smart Factory. And I think pretty quickly we learned, it could really mean a lot of things to a lot of people. But what I took from it was the concept of it is really about adding intelligence to your operation based on moving data across the business far more efficiently and effectively. Now, that could be a daunting prospect for someone who's new to this to engage in. And so I think one of the key things I've taken is, well, actually, you don't have to do it all in one go. You start bit by bit, and you could start with building an intelligent foundation in the same way that you guys have. But the key seems to be connecting the foundation or the vision of the Smart Factory to the corporate goals, and then really understanding your people and winning them over with the right types of communication. And that sounds like it could increase the chances of you getting more buy-in. You could look for quick wins, build a business case with the core team, and sort of almost keep building from there. And this sort of sense of regular, small, conservative steps, and it's a sum of a lot of small steps, could be a large gain. And I really love the way you summed it up right at the end was, if there's something that people are going to take away from this episode is think big, start small and scale fast. So do you feel that's kind of captured our kind of discussion today? Have I missed anything, Andy?
No, I think that's very eloquent, much better than I could have worded it, I guess.
Well, I had the benefit of listening, so brilliant. Okay, well, again, to those of you that are listening, I really hope there's something in today's episode that sparked some curiosity in your minds and maybe even motivated you to want to give it a try. Perhaps you're going to adopt the Think Big, Start Small, Scale Fast methodology. But please, whatever it is, do try something. And so I want to thank my guest today, Andy. It's been great to have you on the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed the experience.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your time. The reason I'm here is to get to meet other people that are going through these same thing. I talk on things like this so I can get feedback from others and learn. So I see this as a learning opportunity for me. So if you're at AU this year and you see me, stop by and say hi.
So thank you ever so much for your time. Been great to have the conversation with you. And to all of you out there in listening land, we'll see you on the next podcast.